Good morning. Please be seated. Carmine versus Carmine, 57148. If the appellant is ready to proceed, please do so. If you wish to reserve any time, let us know how much time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready to proceed.
I'm sorry, I apologize, Your Honor. Yes, I am. May it please the court, thank you for hearing my appeal this morning. My name's Jacqueline Carmine. I'm a practicing public defender. I'm proceeding pro se on this appeal. This is one of three appeals between myself and the respondent, Michael Carmine, a practicing domestic attorney. This appeal looks at financial issues only. Specifically, it addresses the inequitable division of debts and assets, an insufficient award of support as set forth in the trial court's final order.
How do you finance efficiency when it's a highly discretionary matter with the district court?
With regard to support?
Yes.
It is, Your Honor. However, it's my opinion and based upon the statute that the court, one, should have had sufficient information in order to set the support. It didn't have that. It didn't have verification of income. So that's one issue that's of concern. The second issue is that when setting support, the court, in our case, was trying to equalize income. However, it is also required to award alimony when just and equitable at a fair rate based upon the individual circumstances of the parties.
Isn't that hugely discretionary? I mean, there's no bright line, there's no formula that we've ever set out other than that.
There's not a specific formula, Your Honor. However, we do know in this case that the court initially awarded support of $1,200 a month in order to equalize income. And that's not including what I just mentioned, which would be a type of rehabilitative alimony, because as Your Honors are aware, my credit was essentially ruined during this process. And so that's a factor that should be considered as well.
Now, was that awarded prior to the final decree awarding the child support and the other?
The temporary support was different, significantly different than the final support. And the initial award of final support, which was set at the hearing with the parties present, was $1,200 a month. And then the court further on its own did a minute order significantly reducing support at an amount from $1,200 to $450. That's essentially $324 after taxes, and a difference if you look at the four-year period of $36,000. And that was just for equalization of income. That wasn't considering any of the other factors that I was discussing. So that's...
Mrs. Carmine, you're making, as I recall, $81,000 a year as a public defender. Is that correct?
I'm making over that, Your Honor. I'm making approximately, or was making approximately $85,000.
$85,000, okay.
Yes.
So even though you were making that, the court did give you some rehabilitative alimony. I know you're arguing over the amount and all like that, but it's like Justice Perry said, I know that the Supreme Court and the legislature has rejected any efforts to make a formula basis for alimony. So how can you tell us that's an abuse of discretion by the trial judge?
Well, Your Honor, first I'd like to say that in order for the court to set that support, as I said, it needed to have some verification of income. Without that, as the court is trying to equalize income, we're not sure, you know, if the court has accurate information on which to do that.
Well, didn't the court actually work off a presumption that there was approximately $160,000 that your ex-husband was bringing in, and then after an equalization of all the child support reductions and various other offsets, it came to this conclusion on the alimony. So I think I thought there was some basis for the court to make that determination.
Your Honors, I understand when you're concerned.
Maybe I'm mistaken, but.
I understand your concern. However, what should also be noted is that the court did not use the same formula for both parties. It set the support based on, one, subtracting $826 for Social Security a month, when admittedly, after the cap, based on the testimony at trial, this should have been $439, so that number is off.
Is there a statute, or is there a rule, or is there a case law that says the court has to do that?
No, there's no case law that says the court has to use a net or a gross. However, the statute is not silent as to gross income. We know that 125.150 talks about a 20% change in gross income that's required to change alimony. So that is significant that the statute is not silent on that issue. In addition, the court subtracted 190. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Okay, now I'm a little confused.
Sure.
Did the court change a permanent award of alimony, or was there a temporary alimony that was awarded that at some point the court made a determination this is going to be the permanent amount? I just need to have that explained to me.
Yes, sir. The court awarded temporary alimony during the pendency of the proceedings. Once the divorce was finalized, the court awarded $1,200 a month, and then subsequently via minute order changed that amount to $450 a month.
Okay.
And so, Your Honor, and I'm also letting Your Honors know that this formula was not equal. It's not the same formula that the court used for both parties. At a bare minimum, the court should use the same formula for both parties. For him, she subtracted $194 for Medicare. For me, she did not consider my $107 in Medicare. For him, she subtracted that he was withholding 17%. For me, a much lower percentage. It should have been more than double what she considered withholding from mine, which was an amount of $549 that she withheld. It was significantly more. If she wanted to do that, she should have used the same formula.
You say she used net income on one and gross income on the other.
No, she didn't even use gross income, Your Honor. It's difficult to explain, and I myself don't fully understand the formula that the court used, but I can tell you that she did not use the same formula for both of us, because otherwise she would have had those numbers and subtracted those numbers.
Are you saying that's something that we ought to require?
Your Honor, in my opinion, I don't believe that net income is appropriate in this case, because it can be very easily manipulated, as you know. We can have someone withholding more. We can have issues with deductions. We could have issues with someone claiming dependents, deferring compensation. Do we have accounts receivable, accounts payable? We have someone that has a profit share interest in a domestic law firm. We have pre-tax benefits. We have savings. Do we have someone putting money back into the business they have a partnership interest in? Do we have someone buying into the business? These are all issues that could affect a net, and that is of a concern that the court should be aware of. And, Your Honors, I don't think that our judge took all of these factors into consideration, and I don't understand how it could have made this calculation without a single pay stub or a single document. As Your Honors are aware, pay stubs and employer pay period accounting are required by law pursuant to NRS 608.110 and 608.115. There was no reason for them not to have this information, and I believe that the court should have held the litigant, the family law.
So at some point, did you bring a motion based upon failure to make discovery and challenge all these failures?
Yes, it was brought up initially orally in court, and subsequently a motion was filed, and it's my position that the court should have continued the trial, should have had an early case conference, had a case conference report, and fettered out all of these issues before going to trial. We need this information just alone to set child support pursuant to Wright v. Osborne. So that was an issue.
Was this a protracted proceeding? I mean, was there delays for any reason?
The separation occurred in around tax time in April of 2009, and the trial began in January of 2010. I'm not a family law attorney, so I can't say how long the average case takes. In my opinion, there had been no continuances of the financial trial, and I thought that one should have been had, especially in light of this situation. Your Honor, we didn't have any verification of his pension, his profit share plan, That was something that we needed to have. The court should have held Mike to his burden to produce these documents pursuant to 16.1, 16.
But she did award, the court did award half the pensions, both pensions. Is that right?
That's true, but she didn't know what the value of the pensions were, Your Honor. And
but if she awarded half of what the pension, does it matter what the value is?
It does,
Doesn't
Your Honor.
Doesn't that become a post-trial matter if you have a contest as to what the value is?
I believe so, Your Honor. If you look at cases like Fondi v. Fondi, the court looks at things like cash, retirement plans, alimony in a sum total. It doesn't look at each thing and then split it in half. It looks at what the value of these things are, and I think it was essential for the court to have these values, and that was
Were quadros ever done?
I'm sorry?
Were there ever quadros
no,
ever
sir.
Done? Because I'm a little curious why there wasn't just an offset as opposed to having going to the expense of having a couple of quadros. Maybe it's not allowed.
Your Honor, this is a significant issue because with a pension, with a PERS plan, we know having a county plan is a defined contribution, and he may be eligible for postmarital effort funds and postmarital accumulation funds that go into that account, whereas the court essentially said that I was entitled to whatever that unknown amount was in his plan as of February 4th, 2010. We don't know if the firm, because it was its firm's discretion whether or not to contribute to that plan. We don't know if they put any money in that plan. There could be a zero balance in there. We don't know. And post-trial, we have September 27th, I believe, the court making orders that this information needs to be turned over. That should have been done pre-trial. That was Michael's burden pre-trial to produce that information. And so that's my position on the pension. Your Honors, with regard to the debt division, if you look at it, essentially I was allocated 98% of the debt. I was allocated, not including assets, the 2006 car, medical, school, and HOA fees, over $652,000 worth of debt.
Well, my the HOA fees split?
The HOA fees, that's another issue, Your Honor. We're split the date of separation, and it's my position pursuant to Ellett v. Ellett and that these should have been split at the time of the house disposition.
Okay. You have about 3 minutes and 16 seconds left, which is part of the rebuttal time if you wish to say that for rebuttal.
Your Honor, yes, I'd like to stay that time for rebuttal. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for hearing my case.
Mrs. Shapiro, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bruce Shapiro for the respondents.
How'd she get stuck with 94% of the debt?
Well, she's counting the mortgage on the home as most of that debt. So that's how, if in fact her math is right, that's how she came up with that.
What happened to the home? Did it get foreclosed on? Or
if you look at her opening brief, she states that the home was foreclosed upon. So the on page 12, lines 15 to 16, the home is lost. So basically there's no debt, there's no issue. That issue is moot since the home was foreclosed upon.
Wasn't that part of the consideration allocating this? Wasn't there an indication that there was foreclosure proceedings possible or pending?
No, during the pendency of the trial, she testified that she was modifying the loan.
Okay.
Now, Mike, at numerous times, even in closing argument, offered, you know, let's short sell the house, let's let the house go into foreclosure, we'll share any deficiency. She chose not to do that. She wanted to keep the house. Now, there were benefits to keeping the house. She got the tax advantages. She got actual possession. But in most of these negative equity cases, the parties have two choices. One, they let the house go into a short sale or they foreclose, and they share whatever deficiency there is, and we know that there really aren't any deficiency judgments, or one party keeps the house subject to the mortgage. She had her choice, and she chose to keep the house. Now, this is a perfect illustration of why the court shouldn't consider negative equity in dividing property, because it's a phantom debt. It's really not a debt.
Well, the court hasn't recognized the concept of negative equity yet, to my knowledge, Mr. Shapiro. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I could give an illustration why the court should not, is if you have a party with $100,000 equity in a house, and there's $100,000 cash in an account. And that party says, okay, I'll take the house, which is a negative $100,000, and I'll take the account, which is a positive $100,000. It's even. So I'm even. The other party has nothing. That's an equal distribution of debts. Now, the party with the house, after divorce, lets it go into foreclosure, does a short sale, file with bankruptcy. They keep the cash. They get rid of the debt. So they, in effect, got 100% of the community assets. So that's just one reason why the court shouldn't recognize negative equity. Now, I would concede that it could be a different issue if the court told the party, you have to take this house and you have to take the negative equity. That's a different issue than a party saying, I want the house.
Well, that directly, as she mentioned, her credit was destroyed. I would assume as part of this, if it went into foreclosure, her credit was affected, but wouldn't both parties' credit be affected if they were both borrowers on the loan?
Normally it would be, but her name was on most of the credit. And okay. I think if you look back, the credit was really destroyed going into the divorce. The parties lived beyond their means. They spent more than they made. The divorce just exacerbated that situation.
Okay.
As now, to the issue she touched upon, the figuring of income of the parties and dividing for purposes of support, and we understand it's a discretionary call by the court, but how do you respond to the point she was making that two different formulas were used?
Well, there's, I think you have to put into context her claims. One of her claims was that she didn't have sufficient information regarding his income, which is completely false. The answer was filed in April of 2009. There was a case management conference in July of 2009. In July of 2009, the discovery cutoff was set for 30 days before trial. Trial was in January. Therefore, she had from April until December to conduct discovery. Mr. Carman's deposition was never noticed. So if she wanted to question him about his income, why wasn't his deposition noticed?
But he did. You're saying he provided all the required discovery pursuant to the
big issue is that he didn't produce pay stubs.
Right.
But he received his salary electronically. There were no pay stubs. He under penalty of perjury, he completed and produced his financial disclosure statement. He produced his tax return. He produced all of his bank statements. Her counsel noticed the deposition, not of Mike, but of Mike's boss, Ishikunin. Her deposition was noticed. She supplied an affidavit setting forth what his income was that verified every representation that he had made. Rather than having Ms. Kunin testify at trial, they accepted her affidavit and admitted her affidavit in the trial. So we have his employer's representation, signed affidavit, what his income was. We had his financial disclosure form, what his income was. We had his bank statements and we had his tax returns.
What about
she still complains there's no pay stubs.
What about the claim that there was no information given on the retirement accounts and therefore there was no
His retirement statement was provided, but the court hit it on the head that if it's equally divided at the time of divorce, it doesn't matter what it was worth. They couldn't be offset because his was basically profit sharing while hers was the purse. So there was no way to offset those. There was no way to really value hers at that point. So the court just said, Gemma Fondi, we're going to prorate them, and if the quadros weren't done, I don't know what the issue with that is, but they were equally divided, and she had that information.
How many years did she have in PERS at the time, you recall?
I do not recall exactly.
She has to have at least five to vest.
She had at least five.
Okay. Then it can be calculated. I mean,
you can
get a present value on it.
And, Your Honor, the interesting thing about that whole issue is that she never complained about that at the time of trial. In fact, her attorney acknowledged that it was the Gemma Fondi rule. If you look at the transcript on appellate's appendix 1359, examination by her own attorney, the question, Jackie, do you have a PERS program? I do. Question. Do you understand under Nevada law that gets split 50-50 pursuant to the timeline rule? So if it was earned during the marriage, it gets split 50-50. Jackie's answer, that's my understanding. question. Is it your understanding that whether, that when Mike, that when you retire, whether you're with Mike or not, he gets the highest amount which becomes available through PERS program? Jackie's answer, yes. She acknowledged that. She basically stipulated that at trial, but yet she's complaining here. Just like with most of these issues, she either didn't raise the issue at trial, she stipulated to a trial, or she offered no evidence at trial, yet she appeals those issues.
What about the fact she asked for a continuance and wasn't ready to proceed and that request was denied? Was that an abuse of discretion?
Clearly wasn't an abuse of discretion.
Why not?
Let me tell you, there's a lot of reasons. If you look at our opposition to her motion to continuance, we go through all of her bad acts and everything that she did to harass her husband in this litigation. I'd submit to the court that if he wasn't a family law lawyer, she would have been sanctioned and paid severe fees, but that worked as a disadvantage to Mr. Carmine. Again, the action was initiated in April. The case management conference was in July. Trial was in January. She had 9 months. Every piece of evidence she could possibly have gotten was produced. She wanted these phantom pay stubs that didn't exist.
Well, she was represented at that time or
yes.
not?
Throughout yes. this proceeding? One of her five attorneys, yes.
What?
One of her five attorneys that she had during the divorce procedure. But let me tell you, let's talk about what happened leading up to the motion to continue. We're 2 weeks before trial. Then she finally files a motion to continue. Passed the rules, didn't comply with the rules. She filed the motion to continue on January 14th. Trial was January 26th. She waited almost a week before she served us with the motion. 5 o'clock on the seventh day, she served with the motion. So we had as little time as possible to oppose it. If you look at our opposition, it's quite detailed, however, of all the reasons why it shouldn't be granted. She had adequate time. She got every piece of paper that she asked for except the pay stubs. Now, if we can talk about this issue with regards to, and she also talks about the court didn't set an early case conference and there wasn't an early case conference report. The case wasn't even governed by 16.1. There were no early case conferences then. It was 16.2, and on July 8th of 2009, we had the case management pursuant to 16.2. She was there. Her attorney was there. The court set the discovery cutoff 30 days before trial. Her attorney was ordered to prepare the report. These are the types of misrepresentations we've had to deal with. In her opening brief, she says that she never received our confidential trial memorandum. It was filed in open court. Her attorney referred to it in his closing argument. We filed a motion to strike the opening brief for that and other areas. The court gave her the opportunity to file an amended brief. She did, and she still didn't correct these blatant omissions. Let's get to the gross versus net income, though. It's Jackie's position, first of all, that income, alimony should equalize income after divorce. There's no authority that says that. Wright versus Osborne even provides that the court shouldn't necessarily attempt to equalize income. The difference is that Judge Giuliani, when she did temporary support, she basically looked at the parties' gross incomes. When you look at the gross incomes, there looks like a large disparity. Once you look at the tax rates, once you look at the mandatory deductions, I don't know if the court can see this. If it can, I request permission to
look up here.
Approach the bench to give the court a copy.
Please. And if you provide counsel with a copy also.
This is actually part of the record, the respondent's appendix, page 298. This document, these are the numbers that the judge had to do temporary orders. So you're looking at these gross numbers. This is from our confidential trial brief and our post-trial memorandum. But if you look at gross incomes, yes, Mike makes a lot more in gross income. He pays Social Security. He has a higher tax rate. He paid child support. So after all those orders, he made about $284 more than Jackie. If the court wanted to equalize the incomes, it would be $142. The court gave her $450, so she actually has more available income than him.
Well, she was also saying it was kind of unfair deduct Social Security, whereas it didn't. There were certain offsets that were made.
When you're talking about alimony, you have to look at all the circumstances, what the parties actually have. He doesn't get to spend Social Security because that's deducted from his income. Her PERS is added on top of her income. If you look at the last couple pages of the respondent's appendix, you see the county statement. She actually receives $25,000 in annual benefits from PERS. That's added onto her income, so her total income is closer to $115,000. But she's not taxed on that. That's gross income. The court didn't even use that higher figure for child support purposes. Child support purposes is supposed to include all gross income. We asked the court to include her PERS contributions for child support purposes. Despite what Ms. Carmen says, the court did not do that. So not only does he have more deduction, so less net income. She actually has more income that's not even being accounted for.
What about the argument that she made that in order to adjust alimony, there needs to be a 20% change?
What happened was that the court was using, as it did for temporary orders, the court believed that gross income was appropriate to use for alimony purposes. After trial, and after reviewing our trial memorandum, before the decree was entered, sua sponte, she ordered a minute order changing her alimony order because we convinced her that the court should look at net income, not gross income. So it actually wasn't a modification. It was an extension of the trial. I think it was within a day or two of closing arguments. She issued this minute order saying, hey, you know, I made a mistake. I should be using net income, not gross income.
And your argument is that's entirely within her discretion.
It's not only within her discretion, but to do it any other way would be unfair. I mean, again, if you look at this chart and you looked at gross incomes, you go, wow, he makes a lot more money. There's got to be substantial alimony. Once you start looking at the deductions, you realize that she really has more available to her on a monthly basis. Now, one quick point on this is you may say, well, you shouldn't subtract child support. If she had primary custody, I would agree with that. But since they have joint custody and they have the children 50-50, that should be a consideration in how much each party has available to support themselves and the children each month. So if it was primary custody, there's a good argument that shouldn't be included. But since it's joint custody, I think it's appropriate that that is included. So if you look at the statute and you look at the case law, you're looking at the parties as they will be left by the divorce, and you have to look at net available income to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Shapiro.
Thank you.
Either one of you have any additional questions?
No.
Ms. Carmen.
Your Honors, I'd like to... Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to take this time to say that my opponent and I disagree on certain facts. Discovery was not exchanged. The financial disclosure form requires pay stubs.
But what about the argument there are no pay stubs? It's an electronic deposit.
Your Honor, the law provides that pay stubs are required if you request them. And in addition to that, there's employer pay period accounting that's required.
And did the employer submit an affidavit as was represented?
If Your Honors will look at the affidavit, it doesn't state what my opponent claims that it
did. It indicate what the income was?
No, Your Honors.
It didn't indicate an income amount. What about his affidavit?
His financial disclosure form?
Yes.
It indicated an amount, but this was unverified. And, Your Honors, I'd just like to point out.
Did you request any additional discovery to verify that?
He did.
He's indicating that you didn't.
We did. That's not accurate. And
did you request his deposition?
Your Honor, we did request his deposition.
And was that denied?
I'm sorry?
That was denied?
He claimed we missed the discovery cutoff, and that's part of this whole issue.
Counsel, that's an important issue. If the court set a discovery date and that date went by and you didn't make any motions during that time period or shortly thereafter, why should the court at the ninth hour, so to speak, allow additional discovery?
Your Honor, that's not entirely accurate.
Tell us what is accurate. When the discovery period cut off, was a motion made to request any discovery you felt you had requested and had not received?
Your Honor, technically, we never had the early case conference in July because the financial trial was not set at that time and no discovery was exchanged at that time. Pursuant to Rule 26, technically, discovery...
Under 16.2, there are dates and times, and the court usually sends out management orders that prescribes that. When they set the trial and gave you notice of trial, in that, to your attorney, would have been key dates for them to follow.
We did not have that, Your Honor. We did not have that. We needed that, and that's something that we wanted the court to continue the trial and go through that process and have that. We needed that, Your Honor. We needed to clarify what the issue
was. You had 9 months to make an issue of that. That's what I don't understand.
It was brought up, Your Honor, and there were, Mike, I believe, admitted on the record at one point, 3 requests for production of documents.
Counsel, you have about 30 seconds left. Anything specifically you want to tell us that would sway the court one way or the other?
Yes, Your Honor. There's an issue I'd like to address. Alimony, to me, should not be a basis to reduce child support. We needed verified income to properly make this determination. Your Honors are aware that child support and spousal support have alternate purposes. If I was granted a pension or property interest of a more significant value, I would still be entitled to the child support without subtracting the value of the pension or the property. In addition, if you look at his chart, look at the significant difference in the percentage of tax income that's withheld. $340 when I'm earning what he claims to be $7,126. That's not the same formula, Your Honors, and I'd ask you to consider that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank parties for the arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you.
All rise. Court is in recess until the next scheduled argument.